We'll open up the Senate Committee on Business and Transportation for Monday for one of our last four meetings. And we'll open up a public hearing on House Bill 2950. Mr. Stebridge.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, House Bill 2950A establishes an 11-member residential and manufactured structures board to be appointed by the governor and confirmed by the Senate. It specifies board membership in terms of representation. It abolishes the Manufactured Structures and Parks Advisory Board and the Residential Structures Board, transfers their duties, functions, and powers to the Residential Manufactured Structures Board. It also establishes a 7-member Construction Industry Energy Board. It specifies the membership of that board and of the appointment authority. It authorizes the Construction Energy Board to develop proposed state building code standards relating to the efficient use of energy in electrical structural fabricated structures and low-rise residential code provisions. You have the -A4 amendment, which is dated May 15th. It just arrived in our office within the hour, so I haven't had a chance to look at it and see what it does.
Okay. Nathan Phillips, please. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Senator Metzger, Chair, and members of the committee. I also haven't really had a chance to look at these amendments, but I know what was supposed to be in them, and I've been was a member of the Electrical and Elevator Board for about 12 years, and I'm in the construction industry, also work in the development side, and I just wanted to say that the electrical industry and NECA support this energy board. I think it's something that we need to bring more coherence to the energy amendments that get added to our building code. They frequently get handed down without good coordination, and this would be a good thing. Any questions?
Thank you very much for your testimony. Other questions for this witness? No questions. Thank you very much. Also signed up to testify is Andrea Simmons, Building Codes Division.
She's not signed up, but she's the person.
Thank you. It would probably be helpful if you could talk a little bit about what's in the -A4 amendments, because apparently those are new, and maybe you know something about them.
Sure. For the record, my name is Andrea Simmons. I'm the Green Building Services Manager with the Department of Consumer and Business Services Building Codes Division. Before you today are the -4s for House Bill 2950. This is a direct result of a work group or some stakeholder work where we worked together in the interim between the original bill and this bill to come up with a Construction Industry Energy Board. The Construction Industry Energy Board will be a consensus-based board that will actually streamline some of the processes for adopting codes and standards related to energy efficiency and other items that may be contained in the state building codes. The difference between the -3s and the -4s are basically tweaks, if you will, to the language. There were some minor changes to the makeup and the wording for the Residential Manufactured Structure Board's members related to the manufactured home industry.
Mr. Chairman, may I ask a question?
Yes, please.
The -3, we don't have the -3, was that on the House side, or was that?
Yes.
The A and Gross bill represents the -3s.
Yes.
Okay,
sorry.
Thank you.
Sorry for the confusion.
Sorry, thank you.
So there's a couple changes there related to the membership, related to the Residential Manufactured Structures Board, related to the manufactured housing industry. There are a couple of changes related to how the transition will work at the Building Codes Division. We currently have 7 advisory boards. This particular bill combines 2 of the current advisory boards, and so there were some transition language added to the bill to ensure that the rules, the codes, and the decisions made by those boards during the transition as they go from one board to another board or a combined board stay in place and remain in place in the state of Oregon. And then there were a couple other clarifications to really clarify the roles and authority of the energy board that's proposed in this legislation regarding the majority vote, that it takes 5 members out of the 7 to vote yes on an item before it can be forwarded to rulemaking. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Questions? Senator George?
Mr. Chair, can you give me, I'm just a little unaware of exactly how this works. So if this board came up with a criteria that was just strictly based on energy conservation. So let's just say, for instance, a thicker insulation or insulation that was significantly more expensive, could they mandate that all buildings be built with that? So let's say, for instance, Washington could have one standard on this and Oregon have a different standard on this? Or is this more of an advisory board?
This is an advisory board on the state building code right now. It takes two to approve it, both the board and the division. Let me give you a different example if I can.
Okay.
Right now in the state of Oregon, if we were to adopt code provisions related to solar or photovoltaic panels, right now with the current system under our seven advisory boards, we would actually work with at least three boards to adopt those particular provisions. With this new bill, what could happen on that particular provision is we could go to the Energy Board with a vote of five from the appropriate boards, because as you can see, the makeup of this board actually contains some of the members of the other boards. But with a vote of five, we could move forward to rulemaking to adopt those provisions, whereas right now we have to go to all three boards. And if during that process, as you talk to the three, if something changes on board number two, for example, you'd have to circle back to board number one. So it streamlines the divisions and the department's ability to adopt code.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I guess what I'm trying to get at is that building codes has always been something that we've done for public safety. For
mm-hmm.
instance, you know, we don't want the buildings falling down in an earthquake and these different things. And the idea is that we have consistent codes so that we protect the public safety. When we start getting into the areas of energy, the question is are we going into public wants rather than needs? You see what I'm trying to get at? And I'm trying in my mind come up with, could you have building codes put into place that, for instance, somebody was trying to decide between the state of Washington and the state of Oregon to put their corporate headquarters. So they're going to build a fairly large office building that we could, in essence, have such dramatically different. I mean, would this allow? Is this more than advisory? So they could actually be part of the codes. So would be more expensive to build in Oregon than it would be in Washington, simply because these codes mandate something that maybe the cost benefit analysis isn't there. Do you see what I'm trying to get at? It's like, is this become, in essence, part of the code that you have to build a building to this structure, to this code level, and then we could actually become inconsistent with other states as far as the cost of actual construction?
The answer to that is yes, it is part of the code. Our codes are currently based on national models, and that requirement to be based on national models doesn't go away with this particular bill. So in right now, today, there are different standards, if you will, between Washington, Oregon, California, and Idaho right now. But it goes through a public process at this particular point in time. And a lot of our energy codes right now, the U.S. Department of Energy provides guidance to states on what standard, national standard to use and what national standard to meet.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
But it's clear to me that there's no issue about the state of Oregon developing a higher standard or a more expensive standard if you follow Senator George's rationale.
Not that wasn't thought of in this particular bill. This was just to streamline the issues. So that wasn't the purpose of this particular bill. It's to expand the reach of the code that we have now.
Very good. Thank you. Senator Schrader, questions?
Nope.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Appreciate it. Is there anyone else? No one else has signed up to testify. Is there anyone else in the audience that wishes to testify? Mr. Phillips would like to return to the Rostam case. Mr. Berry, please. Thank you.
For the record, my name is Nathan Phillips, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to comment on the questions that Senator George was asking. From the perspective of the construction community and the development community, we really want to see this change and this board created so that the energy provisions that get put in the building code go through the advisory board process where it gets vetted by people that have to build these things and have to pay for them. And currently what's going on is that these provisions seem to come down and they just end up in the code and the community never got a chance to have a voice in it, and this gives us a seat at the table in the promulgation of energy codes, which we haven't had in the past. And I think it'll help with the issues you're talking about, that with costs getting out of control and no one considering, well, energy code's great, but if nobody's building a building because it's too expensive, it doesn't happen.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
That testimony, though, seems to be in conflict with the testimony we just heard from Ms. Simmons, which basically, if I understood correctly, required that before building codes could adopt a particular rule, they had to go to three different boards to get buy-in. I mean, she just said that if one of the boards didn't buy in and they changed it, then they had to go back and get. So am I hearing
well,
inaccurately?
Two different issues, really. Okay. One problem is the problem of multiple boards dealing with construction issues that cross board lines. So the example that she gave of the solar power, which involves structural, mechanical, electrical, all three boards have to get involved. The other problem is the energy provisions being developed by one department being handed to building codes to incorporate into the building code without the building community having an opportunity to have a voice at it. And that's the reason we want this board, we in the industry want this board, so that we can have a voice at the table. I've been an electrical contractor for 25 years, and I've seen these lighting standards and energy standards come into the building code. They never even went through the electoral board. We never saw them. And all of a sudden, we're building to them. Well, a lot of them are great, and we're all for energy conservation, but they have to be workable. They have to be practical. We have to be able to build them. This will give us a better code, I think.
Thank you very much, Mr. Berry.
Scott Berry on behalf of the Oregon Home Builders Association, and I would tend to agree with Nathan's comments. I think the idea behind this is really to deal with issues that are consensus-based within the building code, so that if you have a scenario where an issue like the solar panels comes down, instead of going to three boards, we've got members from each of those boards sitting on the new proposed energy board. With consensus, that issue could move forward. If there was disagreement, it would have to go back through each individual board again for that through that vetting process. And so this is really a step in a streamlining manner to help those issues where the boards are in agreement that something can get done in a manner that would take place much more quickly than if it had to go through all three boards.
Great, thanks. Any questions for either one? Thank you both very much. Appreciate your testimony. Again, is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify on this particular bill? Seeing none, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 2950. And so we've heard all these witnesses. I don't know what you'd like to do, Mr. Chair.
Well, you had an amendment, correct?
Yeah, and everybody just got it. So,
and we don't have a fiscal on the amendment. So okay. We'll get the fiscal on it and see how members are, and we'll roll that bill over to Wednesday. Is that
Thursday?
Okay, till Thursday. Okay, we'll open up public hearing on House Bill 3379. Mr. Stembridge.
Mr. Chairman, House Bill 3379A allows cities to apply for extensions or submit alternatives if unable to meet the transportation funding requirements when amending comprehensive plans in compliance with the transportation planning rule of the Land Conservation and Development Commission. It declares an emergency effective upon passage. We have included a copy of the rule, the Oregon Administrative Rule, that is the subject of this bill.
Okay. We have a panel of three people like to speak. In the order of brevity, I would ask that you be brief, but still cover the important issues. Chris Doty, Eileen Stein, Doug Riggs.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, Doug Riggs with the Central Oregon Cities Organization. We appreciate you having a hearing today. I will be very brief, and I'll let Chris explain this. I will say that this is a bill that we held a hearing on in the House. We took out one significant section of the bill that, as originally introduced, would have provided for the ability for local governments to sequester state income tax revenue that would be created as a result of development and use that to pay for development projects in the region that would be required by the TPR. Because of the financial situation, the limited lottery bonding capacity, and the late nature of the session, we decided to take that portion out. So the bill, as it remains, is something we've worked with the agencies on and with other cities and counties on to give a gentle nudge to ODOT and DLCD to work with us to be a little more flexible in the way they interpret the current TPR. It would not eliminate the TPR. It does not eliminate underlying land use planning regulations, but it does give them a gentle nod in the direction of working with us on more flexibility, especially when it comes to the timing of the financing for improvements that are required from the TPR. So I will let Chris explain the bill if you'd like.
Thank you, Mr. Riggs. What I would like is if you could step aside for a moment. The senator from that district has come into the room, and we'll hear from Senator Telfer first, and then we'll proceed.
Thank you, Chair Metzger and members of the committee. I'm Chris Telfer, Senator of District 27. And I want to thank you very much for moving quickly on this important piece of legislature. This is an issue that is just beginning to come to light in this state, the impact of the significantly revised transportation planning rule is beginning to impact communities where a couple things have happened. One is there's been significant growth, and where communities are beginning to meet the requirement to redo their TSP, their transportation system plans. And eventually all communities will feel the weight and inflexibility of the TPR. And to this point, those communities include Bend and Redmond and Sisters and Madras and Gresham and Hillsborough and Forest Grove, Gaston, Springfield, Medford, and throughout the state. So this is all a result of the amendments to the transportation planning rule. A significant change in the rule essentially mandated that all projects necessitated by zone changes or UGB expansions not only be planned, but here's the catch, but also fully funded for the entirety of the 20-year window. I am all for careful planning, but as a CPA, I also know that it is impossible to guarantee a stream of state revenue for any project over a 20-year period of time. Yet, this is essentially what the TPR has done. This has meant that any city which proposes an economic development project that causes an impact on the state highway, which in many rural areas and urban areas runs right through the middle of their town. I think in my district, we have a state highway that runs through every city, right through the middle of every city in my district. That, well, these cities then must demonstrate how it will fund all the costs of the upgrades that will be needed to fully expand the highway system to accommodate the expected demands over the entire period of the planning process. So this task simply cannot be met. First of all, we as legislature haven't provided the dollars necessary to meet the needs of the transportation growth today, let alone in a 15 or 17, 20-year growth project. Even if the money were available from the state transportation improvement funding window is only 4 years. We can only predict funding for a 4-year period, yet the rule requires us to predict it for a 20-year period. Also, many zone changes anticipate the need to plan for and work towards economic development over a long period of time. Yet, the TPR revisions say that a project that may not be fully developed until years 15, 20 years won't even be allowed to proceed at all until all the funding is identified. This bill gets at these issues by giving the two agencies in charge, ODOT and DLCD, the green light to be a little bit more flexible in their implementation of the rule. It does not eliminate the requirement that funding for projects be available at some point, but it does allow that funding to be identified and phased in over a reasonable period of time. It also allows the agencies to agree to let communities work on alternative plans to meet the TPR goals. For instance, there are other ways to encourage alternative routes or better commuting habits or modification of the way we calculate vehicle trips per mile. These are all fairly common sense ideas, and this bill specifically authorizes the agencies to make sure that in our zeal for a perfect system of transportation planning, we don't inadvertently eliminate the ability of our communities to create economic development, jobs, and tax revenue for the state during these tough economic times. I'm happy to take any questions before I move back to revenue.
Thank you. Any questions for Senator Telfer? Thank you, Senator.
Thank you very much.
Do good work.
Thank you.
Welcome.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Chris Doty. I'm the Public Works Director for the City of Redmond. And I'd like to commend Senator Telfer on an excellent summation of the issues that we're dealing with in Central Oregon when it comes to the TPR. Of course, as Public Works Director for Redmond, it's my job to figure out how to plan for new growth and serve it with the infrastructure that it needs. And, of course, most of you are very familiar with the amount of growth we've had in Central Oregon over the past decade. For the most part, as we're putting our funding plans together for our transportation system plans, we can fund our own projects and we can fund our impact to the state highway system. But we can't fund our own projects and all of the impact to the state highway system that's required by pass-through trips and things of that nature. It just doesn't pencil out with the tools we have in our toolbox, be it property tax, system development charges, what limited gas tax revenue we receive. It just doesn't work, so to speak. The changes made in 2005, as Senator Telfer noted, make it real tough on municipalities to plan and to essentially satisfy the TPR because, again, the state has that four-year window of funding opportunity in the STIP. Meanwhile, the city is preparing a 20-year plan. And so most of the projects we're dealing with are out in year 15 to year 20. And we're not just talking about stop signs converting to traffic signals or even traffic signals converting to interchanges, which are somewhat fundable for the most part. It's large corridors that have to be created. Of course, in the city of Redmond, the recent construction of the reroute being one of those. And so the changes that we were seeking to make with this bill originally, as Doug Riggs noted, we tried to craft a solution from a funding mechanism point of view. A unique income tax sequestration project was proposed to fund economic development projects in expansion areas. However, that's a casualty of our times, and we understand that. There's still a couple elements remaining within this bill which we feel are salvageable and worthy of continued, submittal for your consideration. That being, let's provide some flexibility in the TPR. We realize it's a twofold problem. It's funding projects, but it's also the standard that we're building those projects to. So let's take a look with these remaining amendments as to how exactly what standards we need to construct these projects to. Can we look at the system a little bit differently, get a little bit more life out of it, and accommodate some economic development and expansion within our cities?
Thank you. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Chair Metzger and members of the committee. Thank you for hearing us today. My name is Eileen Stein, and I'm the city manager and Sisters. And for purposes of brevity, I'll call your attention to the picture that is on the second page of the letter that you received. And just to show you that the effect of the TPR has on other levels of government as well. In the case of Sisters, on your visual aid there, you'll see a big sort of almost triangular area in yellow that's split in two, and the upper portion of that property is an area of about 17 acres where the U.S. Forest Service plans to consolidate its offices and relocate its office. It was planning to sell the lower triangle, 53 acres, and use a new federal authority to be able to sell that land and use the proceeds of that sale to relocate and consolidate its offices. The City of Sisters, which is classified by the State of Oregon Economic and Community Development Department as a severely distressed community and has been encouraged by OECDD to take advantage of that designation, did engage in a pretty much year-and-a-half-long community visioning effort to decide what to do with this parcel and how this parcel should develop. It is all entirely within the city limits. Off to the right is the downtown area of Sisters. Above that is industrial land. Off to the left of this triangle, or to the west of it, is Highway 20 and the old Ray's Shopping Center and the new Ray's Shopping Center. So the parcel is really uniquely suited to be a mixed-use retail, kind of a affordable housing, a little bit of an extension of our industrial park. It really can be a mixing zone for a number of different uses, and it has quite a bit of economic prospect to it. At the tail end of our visioning process, we were advised by DLCD that if the city undertook the rezoning in order to make that property more saleable for the Forest Service, that it would be the city that would be responsible for all of the transportation improvements to comply with the TPR. And the advice of DLCD was that the city should not do that. As a result of that, the city put in place some very vague language that said that if the property were to sell, that the city might entertain a zone change at that time. As a result of that advice, the property had received no bids on it when it went open. So it had a very chilling effect on the sale of that property. And we're very concerned about the effect of the TPR as it exists right now on our ability to further develop economically in Sisters. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Stein. Questions for any of our guests? Senator George.
Thank you. What contact have you had with the Land Conservation Development Commission about your frustrations with the TPR? I know that a lot of local jurisdictions stressed these types of problems when they were developing those rules. I mean, we all saw this coming with LCDC going forward with those rules. So have you had any feedback from, because this could be done with by rule if they would just simply change the rules. Is there any movement at the LCDC to change the implementation of the rule to allow you to do this through rule rather than through statute?
After the property was on the market last summer, and so after the sale, we put our energies into trying to address the TPR. We have given that feedback to DLCD, but we plan to sit down in the next couple of weeks and talk more thoroughly with DLCD and ODOT about the and try to figure out what to do to get the sale back on track.
Just, you know, within the industry, it was widely known, I think, when these rule revisions came out. As a result of a lawsuit, JQIP versus City of Springfield, DLCD made these rule revisions. But when they happened, it was known that the burden was really shifting to municipalities in terms of how they fund their transportation improvements long term. And so this is just a natural progression of that, and we've kind of hit the brick wall. We certainly raised this issue with the Department of Transportation as we've updated our transportation system plans, and they've had that conversation with their sister agency numerous times. Of course, in Central Oregon, it's all about providing economic development opportunities due to the amount of land that's been gobbled up over the past decade or so. And so we're really, I think, on some of the first people who are experiencing the impacts of those 2005 amendments.
Yeah, I might add, actually, last summer we did have the Transportation Commission come out to Central Oregon, and we spent quite a bit of time at that meeting talking about the effect of the TPR and the need for some funding vehicle or doing something with mobility standards, and we felt like we really had the ear of the commission at that time.
Thank you. Any others? Thank you. John Chandler, I can't quite read this. Is it Jerry Bullard? And Jack Isselman. Mr. Chandler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. John Chandler, Oregon Home Builders Association, here in support of the bill. I'll be very brief to Senator George's question about taking this up with the agencies involved. As a veteran of about a half a dozen of those taking up with the agency ideas, it's harder than you might think. This is, I think, a good bill and a good way of addressing the issue, particularly in the area without a wholesale revision of the transportation planning rule. I commend it to you. I think it's good these cities brought it forward. Future conversations on this topic, I suspect, will be in front of you, not necessarily this session, but it's this bill is a good place to start. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Jerry Bohard with the Oregon Department of Transportation. I'm the Transportation Development Division Administrator. And we've obviously been having a lot of conversations with Central Oregon. As they've mentioned, this came about changes for JQIP back in 2005. And one of the things that the changes that did allow was essentially what is termed reasonably likely. And so for our agency to make a determination of reasonably likely. In actuality, what this rulemaking is doing is really putting forward a structure for us to make that in a very deliberate fashion. In fact, the Oregon Highway Plan allows for differences in performance standards and what we call alternative mobility standards. So really the premise that they're bringing forward in the bill is outlining the Oregon Highway Plan, so this just brings some more structure to it. So unless there's any questions, that's where the agency is at this point.
Okay. Mr. Isselman.
Thank you, Chair Metzger. For the record, Jack Isselman here today on behalf of the City of Hillsborough. I would just echo the support that the proponents of the bill have offered today. We submitted detailed testimony in the House on this bill. We think it's a good bill that will help us achieve our economic development plans in Hillsborough and throughout Western Washington County.
Thank you. Is there any questions? Okay. We'll be bringing this bill back. I intend to move it, but there may be a few hitchhikers on it. We'll close the public hearing. House Bill 3379. And we'll open up a public hearing on House Joint Resolution 43. Mr. Stenbridge.
Chairman, House Joint Resolution 43 recognizes the importance of Oregon small businesses to the Oregon economy. It resolves that Oregon small businesses, as stakeholders and key contributors to the state's economy, be taken into account when considering and enacting legislation.
Fred King, Chuck Jones, and Christine Chin Ryan, please.
There's actually four.
I can only do three at a time. So, first three.
You want to go fourth?
No, I'll go.
The two of us are first.
Everybody will get their time.
Mr. Chairman, welcome. Thank you. Members of the committee, thank you very much for allowing us to be here. I'm Chuck Jones. I'm a small business owner in Portland. I've resided in the state since 1976. I've been a small business advocate for many years. I'm on the SBDC's State Advisory Board in Portland, the Small Business Advisory Council, excuse me, the NFIB Oregon Leadership Group, and for several years I was ex officio member of the Governor's Small Business Council, and I've been signing small business payroll checks for over 45 years. How did this get started? Excuse me. Several years ago, the state director of SBDC's mentioned to me that Maine had passed a Small Business Bill of Rights. In doing some research, I discovered that was the only state, although the U.S. House had also passed one. Now, Texas and Hawaii have also passed one. I think it was the last legislature I introduced this to a few senators and representatives, and in Portland to the Small Business Advisory Council. There was no traction on a state basis because I didn't know how to do it, I guess. But we got traction in Portland, and we had 10,000 businesses endorse this, and the City Council passed it unanimously, and I think you have a copy of it in front of you now, on November 29th of 07. But why, in the midst of a recession, would we be even bothering you with something which may seem trivial? I'm sure I don't have to tell you that small business is the economic engine of this state, and small businesses is what have led us out of every economic recession in our history. It also, with passage of this, would make small business front of mind aware, so that there aren't unintended consequences on small businesses as additional regulations and laws are passed. And it lets others know that not only is Portland becoming business friendly, but the entire state is becoming business friendly. So we urge passage of H.A.R. 43, and thank you for allowing us to testify.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, committee members, thanks for the opportunity to testify in support of H.J. 43, or otherwise known as the Small Business Bill of Rights. For the record, my name is Fred King, and I'm testifying today specifically as an individual and small business owner who has been fortunate to run his own businesses in Oregon for over 35 years. I've had in the past the opportunity to serve on the Governor's Small Business Council and the Regional Economic Task Force. I'm a current member of the Oregon Small Business Advisory Council, the 12th Chamber of Commerce, the NFIB of Oregon, and the OSBRL. The importance of small business to our state is undeniable. In this economy where we are experiencing 12% unemployment, we have today an opportunity to recognize the importance of small business to Oregon in the eventual recovery of our economy. Small businesses account for 98% of the approximate 112,000 employer firms in Oregon. It has been said that small business is a heartbeat and driving economic force for our great nation and will be the driving economic force during these difficult times. This can equally be said for small business in the state of Oregon. HJR 43 identifies Oregon as a business-friendly state and specifically highlights the importance of pro-business objectives to the health of our great state. With the importance of small business to Oregon, the Small Business Bill of Rights distinguishes small business as a critical stakeholder to include when making rules, regulations, and laws. Our economy is simply too reliant on small business not to consider the adverse effects of making regulation, rules, and laws on the tens of thousands of small business owners in our state. We aren't asking to be treated differently, instead to consider small business owners as stakeholders to the future of our state. A few specific pro-business objectives are highlighted in the Small Business Bill of Rights. With HJR 43, Oregon small businesses have a right to access to clear, stable, and predictable regulatory and record-keeping requirements, equal access to economic development tools, critical infrastructure services in the Oregon economy, including access to education and technical assistance in starting and operating a business, access to an economic culture that encourages and sustains the growth of small business. It is my belief that these objectives will help stimulate small business, the economy, and the state of Oregon. And HJR 43 has absolutely no negative fiscal impact on the budgetary constraints that you as legislators are currently facing. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. King. That's why we like HJRs and SJRs. They have no fiscal impact.
Yeah, there you go.
So, thank you very much. All right. Now, Batty.
Chair Mesko, members of the committee, thank you for giving us the time to address you before you on House Drawing Resolution 43 and for sponsoring it. For the record, I'm Christine Chen Ryan. I'm president of Synergy Consulting, Inc., a Oregon company since 1988. I'm also chair of the Oregon Small Business for Responsible Leadership and chair of the Oregon Small Business Healthcare Initiative, former chair of the Governor's Small Business Council, and currently a member of the Oregon Small Business Advisory Council. As Chuck said, he borrowed the concept from Maine and successfully advocated for it in Portland. The OSBRL also liked it so much that we rewrote it, in particular Tatiana Lischitz, who will be testifying, so that it does not have any fiscal impact, which is very good in this economic climate. I want to give you a few of the high points of my written testimony, but first I want to give you some statistics on small businesses in Oregon, and it's attached to the written testimony. Oregon small business definition is less than 100 employees. It is in statute. We account for 51% of private sector employees, 98% of the approximately 112,203 employer firms in Oregon are small businesses. The 20 to 49 size class provides the largest number of small business jobs, 203,339. The purpose and meaning of House Joint Resolution 43 is to bring the small business up to equal status with large businesses in Oregon, to recognize the key importance of small business to the Oregon economy, to emphasize the earned right to equal access to economic development tools, such as equal consideration of the small business needs. House Drawing Resolution 43 does not have any fiscal impact. It is a philosophical declaration, and it calls attention to the notion that has been absent until now. The notion is that small business must enjoy the same access to economic tools. It is high time the state of Oregon that we adopt this notion. Thank you, Chair Metzger, members of the committee, for your time.
Thank you. Welcome.
Chair Metzger, members of the committee, my name is Tatiana Lifshitz, and I am the chair of the administrative law of the Oregon Small Business for Responsible Leadership. I work with Christine on that organization, and I happen to draft most of the text of this resolution, and a lot has been said already today. That's very valuable points in support of this resolution, and I would like to echo Chuck Jones's and Fred's also testimony, and simply say that the figures we have seen so far also indicate that the employment from small business firms is slowing, and it would be a very appropriate time to encourage small businesses and provide for a more welcoming atmosphere for that, for them to have equal access to economic development tools. And I specialize in international business and finance law, and I've worked in a number of countries, and many countries are now trying to pass this sort of legislation, and we have, myself and professionals like me, we have seen a very positive impact on the public mentality, and of once they become aware of this notion and welcome small businesses into their economic development net. So I urge you to pass it.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Any questions? Senator Berger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As a small business owner for about 38 years and as an elected official for 20-some-odd, I wish I had wonderful words for you that would make you just rise high on the radar in this building. I don't know that you are ignored because of large business. I don't see that, and I would just like to share that with you. I don't think that people in the building look at large business in a more positive way. I think it is that maybe small business and the economic impact that you put into the economy is taken for granted. And the reason that I say that is I'm a senator from District 5, which is Coos Bay to Lincoln City. Now, I want you to just think about that stretch of the coast. All I have is small business, many ma and pa businesses, very small businesses. But they do quite a bit of business. Depot Bay goes from 2,000 people to 10,000 sometimes on the weekend. So you're preaching to the choir with me, and you have a friend and an ally. And I wish that I had the answer for you today. All I can say is that I really am very supportive of HJR 43. I'm happy to see that the Portland City Council certainly gave you the approval, good housekeeping stamp of approval, on a great Bill of Rights. And don't stop your efforts, because they are very worthwhile, and you speak for many, many, many people in Oregon.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Senator Stark.
I don't have a question. I think, along with Senator Verger, again, I appreciate you bringing the resolution to us. I think it's important. In my experience here in the legislature, it does seem to be that big business seems to win out in a lot of the votes that we cast, a lot of the policies that we move forward. In fact, the conversations we're having today about raising revenue seems to fall disproportionately on small business as opposed to large businesses. You know, when we talk about raising taxes on quote unquote the rich, you're talking about the rich happens to be folks that that are owners of LLCs or partners in LLCs or owners of partnerships, folks that file Form C in your taxes. I mean, those are the folks that seem to be inadvertently or singled out to pay higher taxes, whereas you know, large corporations don't necessarily fall into those categories. So I encourage you to continue your advocacy as this legislature wraps up its work, and be the voice of small business. And small business isn't necessarily rich, but they're the ones that are the job producers, the innovators, the entrepreneurs, those that are producing folks, producing products and services, and putting Oregonians to work. And if this legislature intends to tax the rich and at the same time penalize those same innovators, entrepreneurs, job-producing companies, all we're going to do is potentially lengthen and extend the recession that we're currently enjoying.
Thank you. Yes, small businesses are often the risk takers.
Any other questions?
I'd like to say thank you, Senator Starr and Senator Verger. We are also involved in, we gave input and testimony to the corporate minimum, advocating for small businesses only. Mm-hmm. We're also very active in the healthcare. So we are trying to fight as much we can, as we can, to have a strong voice of small businesses in some of the legislation here in this session. Thank you.
Thank you.
I had just a procedural question.
Yes.
We've noticed that from our draft, in one of the in the item four, the word equal has been dropped when this was drafted, and I was wondering what it would take to consider to put to insert it. It must have been just simply an omission.
Well, the bill hasn't been amended, uh-huh. So it hasn't been changed since it's been in the House.
Right.
So it is the same way it was. So I don't know how to answer your question. But because we haven't changed the bill, and the House did not change it.
Right. No, I meant from the original concept.
Oh.
Writing.
Yeah. Are you happy with it, though, as it is?
Well, I was just wondering, in that item four, that Oregon small businesses have a right to due equal consideration. Can that word be inserted?
Well, I tell you what. I appreciate that. Because, you know, due consideration, equal consideration.
I don't know.
Yeah, I kind of want to pass it. And I'm worried that we don't pass it because we only have three meetings left.
Okay.
So maybe it'd be, if this was January, that'd be a no-brainer. But
right.
I think we get the message. Senator Verger talked about being part of the choir. I think you got the whole choir here. I think the choir is ready to sing on the resolution. So, okay?
We wish the rest of the state was as unanimous as
yeah.
you are.
Well, we got a good committee for you there. We'll close the public hearing and open a work session on House Joint Resolution 43.
Mr. Chair, I move that HJR 43 be sent to the Senate floor with a due adopt recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved HJR 43 to the floor with a due adopt recommendation. Discussion.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Senator George.
Following up on what Senator Starr said, my staff, after I was looking down here, the House passed this bill 50-0. But looking at the House proposal for tax increases that came out last week, of their 31,000 evil rich people that they are going to tax to raise 2% on, almost 70% of those are actually small and family businesses who those are tax forms that have K-1 pass-through income or file a Schedule C. And I find it ironic that the House can pass this 50-0 and then turn around and advocate for raising taxes on small businesses by 2% from 9 to 11, and yet for big businesses in the state, C corporations are only going to raise it by 0.9%. So we're going to double the tax increase. We're going to make it a 3.5% difference. If the House proposal went through, it would have 3.5% difference between small business paying 11% and big business paying 7.4%. I just find that ironic, and I'm going to be voting for this and continue to advocate for small business, and I think that that needs to be pointed out as often as possible that when you talk about the rich, what they're really talking about is 70% of those filers are the small and family businesses in the state of Oregon whose corporate or business taxes show up on their personal income tax forms. So thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Berger.
I'd just like to respond that the corporate minimum has been that way for as long as I've been in the legislature, I do believe. So I don't think that's something new that the corporations are not paying their fair share.
Well, I'm sure we'll have more discussion on that. Okay, is there any objection to the motion? Not so ordered. Who would like to carry this resolution?
Senator, I would.
Senator Schrader.
Carry this one.
Senator Schrader will carry. Thank you. Open up the public hearing on House Bill 2739A. Mr. Stembridge.
Mr. Chairman, House Bill 2739A modifies the motor vehicle inventory for which a dealer may be allowed fair and reasonable compensation upon termination, cancellation, non-renewal, or discontinuance of franchise. It increases the damage threshold for required disclosure to prospective purchasers of new motor vehicles from $500 to $1,000.
Okay, Mr. Gallagher, you're the only one that signed up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Tom Gallagher, representing the Oregon Automobile Dealers Association. Small businesses here in Oregon who are taking a terrible pounding right now. The purpose of this bill is to help them to some small extent. It identifies a couple of changes in the franchise bill, which are the agreements between the Oregon dealers and the major manufacturers. I'm happy to say the major manufacturers have agreed to all of the changes that are in House Bill 2739A. I'll run through them very quickly for you. If you look in on line 12 on the bill, it changes the term current model year to current calendar year. That covers a glitch when a model year is actually skipped by a manufacturer, and we've had a situation in which those vehicles that were on the lot that were made that year are no longer qualified under the recovery. It takes out the language on 8,500 pounds, which puts trucks into the franchise dealership agreements here in Oregon. And the other change on that page is it goes back to the current model year. On the next page, there's another small change at the bottom of page 2, which changes the dealer disclosure for small damage that's done in transit from $500 to $1,000. That's simply an inflationary raise, and that's 10 years ago that went into effect. Under other provisions of the law, anything that bolts on or screws on is not covered by this section, so it basically covers rock chip things in the window and paint scratches, which are running in excess of $1,000 to do a repainting of a door or something like that. And just the last thing I'll say on that, if you look up in Section 5, right above Section 6, the same $1,000 applies to the dealer as does to the customer. So the dealer and the customer stand in the same shoes. If the dealer sees right now more than $500 worth of damage, he can return the car to the manufacturer. We see these small paint scratches and so forth being able to be fixed in the shop, and there are no damage to the vehicle in any way, shape, or form that would harm the consumer. The Department of Justice has looked at this bill and has no objection, and behind me sits the representative of GM. The representative from the other manufacturers has given me his consent to say they support the bill. So, thank you.
Well, thank you, Mr. Gallagher. You know, I've been thinking about this bill all weekend, and I got a lot of people working on it, and this bill is going to have some riders on it. Just clarify for me these requirements, especially with what happened with Chrysler, because it was not actually the bankruptcy court that broke the agreement with our seven dealers. It was there was an understanding in bankruptcy court, but the decision was actually made then by the company post the judge and asking the judge to approve it. Would this have any impact at all, this piece of legislation, on those seven dealers?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, it's my understanding, no, that bankruptcy law sets aside the state franchise agreements. It would have some impact on GM if GM does not go through bankruptcy.
Yeah. You know, colleagues, and I know you're aware of this, you know, this has been very frustrating. And that's why I met with Legislative Council Friday. I've met with some other people who are really great in the law and asked them to come up with any idea, possibility, any monkey wrench, frankly, that we can throw in support of some of our family businesses in this state, particularly with Chrysler, because basically they made a decision that still is very unclear as to why they made what they made. At least with General Motors, who was making some of these decisions, they didn't come out and basically say, you're going to be out the door in 20 days. So, you know, at least there's a transition period. What Chrysler has failed, what did is just basically said in 3 weeks, you're a successful business and you're no longer in business, which I just find, you know, unbelievable. I was at, I went to a rally at Timberline Dodge. My friends there, I've been in business 75 years, a successful business. So, you know, businesses go under because they're not successful. This is a successful business. And it was a rally there, and it was great. There was over 100 folks there, their friends and, you know, people who came to support the dealership. And I was really moved by the owner, Art Laws, Mr. Gallagher, and Mr. Remsensberger from your organization was there and spoke briefly as well. You may know Art. He's the guy, you know, a better buyer, I'll eat my hat, you know, became very, very well known. And the words he said, I think, were just really stunning. He says, you know, the federal government's giving money all this to Chrysler, our tax dollars. And he said, I can't understand how in America I am giving my tax dollars to put my employees and my family business out of business. My tax dollars are paying to put us out of business. And it was just extremely, as you can imagine, frustrating. And if you look at, say, like the service departments, and I don't know about the other dealerships, but I'm going to assume some are in the same, you know, successful mode. So I know Timberline, and I think they were just a perfect example of this. You have a service area, and it's very successful. That's what's keeping the business going now, because new car sales are down, you know, across the board. And you can't keep that going because they say, oh, by the way, we're not going to honor warranties of our cars at your service department. So that puts your service out of business. Well, we got a great body shop. We will not honor warranties if we pick cars up to Chrysler standards at your body shop after this date. So your body shop is out of business. And this is, you know, their tax dollars doing to do this. And according to the stats from the Oregon Auto Dealers Association, of these 17 dealers, and I'm talking about just the Chrysler dealers now, they average 51 employees. Now, these are people, for the most part, making very good wages, are getting health care benefits. These are people that have pension benefits. They're not out there clearing brush for $8.50 an hour, and they're paying mortgages and everything else. And you multiply the 17 times those 51, you know, that's 860-some family jobs that were self-sustaining, that through no fault of anybody but some suit in Detroit has decided not to be in business anymore. Anyway, I don't know if there's anything we can do about this, Mr. Gallagher, but I tell you, I've got everybody possible. I got our whole LC. I said I want them all talking, and we're going to meet, I guess, this afternoon. Any ideas to do on this? And what I have thought of, committee, is using something that we did with the stimulus bill back in January. We declared an emergency, and yes, as a real declared emergency, you don't have to go through the normal public contracting, but say that our Department of Administrative Services, that any new vehicles that they purchase, any of our agencies, as long as the vehicles meet their standards that, you know, require them to declare an emergency and purchase those vehicles from these dealers that have been told to eat their inventory, that they pushed upon them, and they're just sitting there. I said, well, that's at least we can do is have the state come in, and we're going to buy vehicles. We're going to buy from those people and support those businesses. So that's the only thing I've come up with so far. But, Mr. Gallagher, I would be very interested. And I know the committee. We have a person who is also a longtime family member of a business that is right surviving today but doesn't know about tomorrow or next week under this. And I'd be curious to see from your organization's standpoint, if you come up with any ideas in which we can be helpful or anything to be able to say, you know, we just hear talk about small businesses out of business that are successful because people have their own system for figuring something out.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my first suggestion is that you move this bill to rules because you're not going to be able to put some of these complicated pieces together in the next couple of meeting days.
Don't be so sure.
<That's>
But I understand your point.
I felt more comfortable when I was here as a chicken, Mr. Chair. my second comment is that the auto dealers have retained local counsel. That is dealing both on the national level. There is national counsel retained on the Chrysler issue and local counsel, and that it would be very, I think we should be consulting with these people as we go along, which is one of the reasons why I thought time was something of the essence. So it's possible that there are other things we can do. These are certainly not things which I'm confident
in a bankruptcy situation, in situation to talk about. And going forward, I also have to say that, you know, there's a number of dealers that have been damaged here, and it is a very serious situation, especially the smaller communities where these jobs are going out, not to disparage the larger communities, but the impact on jobs. But we still have dealers left in the state. So, you know, this bill will help us one way or the other, and we would be very happy to work with you over the next few days to bring counsel down, to bring Greg Remensberger, who is back in D.C. now for the rest of this week. Again, having the right people here at the right time on your committee schedule is not the easiest thing to do.
Yeah, well, I would say, and I appreciate that, Mr. Gallagher. Time is of the essence, because with these dealers, they have 20 days left. So they don't have the luxury of waiting. And if there's anything we can do, I think we should do it, whether it's to help purchase inventory or it's help to provide some legal tool. I mean, I've learned how you can make retroactive laws. We just did that with the halide. I'll make retroactive laws, anything, to at least to show that we're going to help fight for these people in Redmond, in Medford, in Portland, you know, if they're going to be on the call. I don't care where they are, that we're not just going to sit down and take this. So
we appreciate the offer, Mr. Chair. And we'll
Mr. Chair, you can look at 3,000 more with GM.
What's that?
3,000 more dealers with GM.
Yeah, and
that's their list is already made as well.
Yeah.
Oregon actually came out very well, very well. Some states were hit much, much harder in Oregon, and some of the dealers really feel like Oregon got by. Now, that doesn't mean the ones that were affected weren't hit hard, but there were a number of others that really felt like they were going to be on the cut list. And
yeah, well, it's, and you know this very well, Senator, the frustrating thing about it, and I can say even with the GM and, you know, a couple up the street from Timberline, and then Murray, which is longtime family in Gresham, it's a GM. Mm-hmm. And I'm not saying it makes it any better, but at least, you know, it's over the next year they're going to work with them, and they just don't say, hey, you know, thanks for 75 years, and, you know, everything you got now you own, we don't want it back.
But that's why they went into bankruptcy, is because when you go into bankruptcy, otherwise your franchise agreement is pretty strict, and
no,
they would have to pay you. And so if you go into bankruptcy, the franchise agreements are null and void, and there's not really anything that anybody can do. That's just a fact of life. And that's what's so frightening about it. But even Chrysler Financial is no longer in existence, and so that's completely gone. So I think, though, that when you look at the economy that has really brought a lot of this down, the manufacturers and the American auto industry is in serious, serious trouble, just hanging on by their fingernails.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, and that's very true, Senator. And but I think the fairness and the of how these things operate is what's in question, and the decision making that was is in question, how that was decided, who decided it. The other thing is, you know, as by a dealer, a product and everything else will necessarily consolidate dealerships over time. I mean, that's just how that works. That's a lot different than someone taking your successful business and saying you're not going to be in business anymore. Because as a dealer, and I've had some experience with this, you've had a lot of experience with it, is that the dealerships do not cost the manufacturers much money. I mean, you do your own printing, you floor your own, you pay for your own cars,
absolutely,
you pay for your own parts. That doesn't save the manufacturer money simply by cutting the dealer, you know, network. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this idea that cutting dealerships is going to save the manufacturer a bunch of money is not true. You know, those costs are paid by the dealer.
Well, flooring, though.
Yeah. It's
flooring
just,
is another whole issue, and that's a huge issue in this cut list.
Yeah,
was flooring and overhead capital.
Yeah, and they get essentially write that off. And so then what happens? Right, then you get these businesses have to declare bankruptcy. And guess what happens then? And their suppliers and the people who depend on them.
It's
Mr. Gallagher, you want to comment?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I would be remiss if I didn't add that one of the proposals that's being considered by this body, which is a business gross receipts tax, hits this type of an industry disproportionately dramatically when you have a huge inventory and a huge basis for your gross receipts, but you are making probably no profits at all and probably losing money or close to losing money right now. Writing a check at the end of the year for business gross receipts is also going to have an employee impact. So there are lots of pressures facing this industry right now, and I appreciate working with you to do anything we can to help these people.
Well, thank you. And thank you for allowing me to vent on that. It's just totally, you know, without understanding. Those are not the things that have hurt Chrysler or General Motors as their dealership. It's
well, in the dealer body, I'm so glad that you pointed out, the dealer body is very separate from the manufacturers. I mean, so Tom knows that because he represents probably some of the best, most stable business guys around. They're a great group of people and entrepreneurs, and I have certainly enjoyed a long, long-term relationship with them. And we were very, very concerned about our dealership and were very relieved when it wasn't on the cut list.
Yeah. And but the reality is you don't know about next week or next month or what fiat.
Well, we have the letter.
Yeah, you got a letter.
The letter is in Jim's hand for the franchise, but we don't know what the new agreement will
be. Yeah, you'll be selling Renaults. That's what you're going to be selling.
There's the catch.
I know. Thank you, committee. Anyway, there may not be a lot, but we're going to try to do what we can the next few days with this, and then we'll move it on. So we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2739A. Open up a work session on House Bill 2252, and then we'll be out of here. Mr. Stembridge.
Chairman, the House Bill 2252, you heard in March, the original bill involves the Public Utility Commission's Telephone Residential Service Protection Fund. It's called the RSPF, and it broadens some definitions. It had an extension of the sunset to January 1st, 2020. Your amendment takes all of the other provisions out, leaving that sunset extension.
Thank you. Mr. Willis, you want to come forward? Colleagues, we heard this a long time ago, and I basically held it because it was related to telecommunications, and I just didn't know what was going to happen. I know there was a few little questions, may not have been particularly serious, but what the Dash 1 Amendment, which I support, it basically just extends the sunset. We'll talk about other issues in another day, and that's what we're looking at. Mr. Willis.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Rick Willis with the Public Utility Commission. That's exactly right. As amended, this bill just extends the program from January 1st of 2010 to January 1st of 2020.
Okay. Any questions for Mr. Willis? Okay, we're in work session.
Mr. Chair, move the Dash 1 Amendment to House Bill 2252.
Senator Starr has moved the Dash 1 Amendment to House Bill 2252. Discussion? Any objection? So ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move the bill to the Senate floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved House Bill 2252 to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Discussion? Any objection? So ordered. And Senator Starr, would you carry that?
Sure.
Okay. Before we adjourn, tell me a little bit about us about Wednesday. We've got only four meetings of this committee left, so maybe a bit about what's coming up on Wednesday.
Mr. Chairman, we have seven miscellaneous urgent measures for your consideration on Thursday.
Yeah.
Okay. Committee, just as a kind of an overview here, we've got
Wednesday.
These four meetings left. We've got some bills that are pretty fast and probably won't have much issues, I don't think. We got a couple big bills, and that has spent a lot of time in the House, just as ours sometimes in the Senate, but we're not going to have time to spend the kind of time, obviously, to do this. So please read them, answer your questions, so we can give fair consideration with the time that we have to those bills. But I know you may be inundated by some people on some bills, and this is not January. So, and remember, any amendments to bills have to be printed and have to get a fiscal. If we're going to amend the bill, think about that, because we probably won't be able to do it, or otherwise we lose the bill. So try to do anything. If you want to do an amendment with something, I'd like to know about it, first of all, but Mr. Stembridge definitely needs to know about it, say by Wednesday, to have any hope of getting it printed and also getting a fiscal so that we could successfully entertain it. And then finally, as you all are aware, Senator Starr and I requested, and the President agreed, to form a joint transportation committee, which is us and the House, because the way the timeline was going, we would never touch the transportation bill, and that's not fair to you, and so we will be a joint membership as soon as we hear on a time to hear House Bill 21-2001. We'll let you all know, and we'll deal with the transportation bill together. Is there any questions?
Mr. Chairman, I believe we're trying for Friday on that joint committee meeting. Is that your understanding?
Okay. Yeah, I heard late in the week. Yeah. So we have a time, we'll get to everybody. Okay, we're adjourned.